Hello, welcome to another episode of Artifacts. If you are new to this podcast, I'm your host, Rachel Wilson. I'm an elementary educator with over 20 years of teaching experience. My goal is to provide listeners with a brief blast of history or science that offers background information and answers questions. It is my hope that listening stirs up great conversation for kids, families, and adults too. I also hope listening motivates you to chase after what you are curious about. Hello, and welcome to an episode of Artifacts. Recently, my class has been studying triangular trade. We did an artifact sort a couple of weeks ago, and my students were surprised to see that sugar doesn't start out looking like the granulated white stuff we get in the packets at restaurants. A few questions came up from them and me. I was reminded of stories my neighbor used to tell me years ago about the popularity of the sugar beet factory in Janesville, Wisconsin. So it got me thinking, this episode centers around the sugar packet. Some of our questions were, where did sugar originate? Why were the Caribbean and South America so good for growing it? Why had it become a commodity and a cash crop? Why was it so labor-intensive to cultivate and harvest? So a couple things just to get out of the way here, a couple vocabulary words. Let's start with commodity. A commodity is a raw product of value that can be bought and sold. An import is a product that's brought into the country from outside the country, and an export is a good or service that is outside, being sold outside of the country where it's made. Let's start with table sugar as we know it today. The little white packets we see in restaurants, sometimes it comes in cube form instead. Sometimes we measure out the fine crystals from a bag. Sugar can be derived from sugar cane, beets, palm trees, and maple trees. All of these plants contain sucrose. We're going to focus on sugar cane in this episode. Sugar's made from the leaves of the cane plant. It's in the leaves that the chemical process of photosynthesis takes place. The sugar cane plant is a tropical grass that looks quite a lot like bamboo, but it's not hollow inside the way bamboo is. It can grow from 10 to 13 feet tall. These plants need warm, sunny weather. They need well-drained, fertile soil and lots of water. Let's take a look at their soil for a minute. In my class, in the last couple of weeks, we were talking about pH levels of substances and comparing different levels. Sugarcane likes soil with slightly alkaline levels or a little more sweetness to their soil. When soil is too acidic, plants that prefer alkaline soil can't absorb the nutrients they need to. So they're going to find the right kind of soil in the South Pacific Islands. It makes sense that sugarcane originated in the South Pacific Islands where all of those conditions are being met. Sugarcane takes 14 to 18 months to grow before harvesting. They grow best from June to November and are ripe between January and May. Now for a little history of the sugarcane plant. My students were surprised to learn that sugar crystals don't grow on a plant somewhere and that there isn't a factory making sugar out of nothing. Originally, sugarcane was chewed raw. It's a rather fibrous plant, so chewing the stalk and leaves would release the sugary juice. Over time, sugarcane was introduced to the mainland of Asia and India. At first, it was ground into a powder and used as a medicine to treat headaches and stomach aches in India. When Arabs got a hold of the sweet plant, they improved on the refinement of sugar. As time passed, it's possible that the British and the French crusaders came into contact with sugar as they were fighting for Christianity. When Europe first experienced sugar, only the very rich could afford it. Take a second and think, is there some other natural sweetener Europeans may have had access to instead of sugarcane? I'll give you a minute to think about that. Let's hear a word from our sponsors. If you thought of honey, you are correct. However, honey was not easily accessible since an efficient way of extracting the honey from the comb had not been invented yet. There was usually some bothersome wax in the product, and the taste was much stronger. Plus, the taste of the honey is not always compatible with the dish it's supposed to sweeten. Since sugarcane wasn't easily accessible and couldn't be grown well in Europe, it was considered a luxury. That is until one particular explorer brought sugarcane over to the New World. Can you guess who that was? Christopher Columbus. When Christopher Columbus made his second voyage to the New World in 1493, he brought sugarcane stalks from the Spanish Canary Islands. By 1505, the first slave ship arrived in Brazil from West Africa. By this time, Portuguese colonies had already started trading posts in Africa to trade ivory and pepper. The first commercial sugarcane crop was documented in 1640. It seems there were some behind-the-scenes reasons for sugar to take off in the Western Hemisphere. There was the Little Ice Age of 1550 to 1700 that reduced the average temperature in the Mediterranean and lowered their rainfall. Brazil was not suffering from these climate changes. There were also some wars going on in the Mediterranean area that were keeping the availability of the sugar down, which then was driving the prices up. Sugar quickly became a cash crop for British colonists. In fact, British colonists referred to sugar as white gold. By the mid-1800s, more than 10 million enslaved Africans were moved to Brazil and Caribbean islands to work on sugar plantations. By this time, sugar accounted for one-third of Europe's entire economy. Which leads me to talk about the triangular trade. So we're seeing a connection here between the Silk Road. So sugar would have traveled along the Silk Road. It would have also traveled from East Asia to the West by warfare and conflict. And now we're into talking about the triangular trade, where we have the Old World meeting the New World. At the bottom of the triangle, we have Africa and South Central and North America. African people were forced onto slave boats and brought to South and Central America to work on the sugar plantations there. As the demand for sugar in Europe increased, plantation owners increased their labor so they could produce more sugar. The most inexpensive way to do this was with enslaved people. More sugar to ship meant more profit for plantation owners. As we were talking about triangular trade in our class, we were wondering why were so many people needed to supply the demand for sugar? So let's talk about that for a minute. First, sugarcane had to be planted in rows. It was planted by digging a trench and putting old canes in end to end, or digging a hole and putting 2-foot-long canes in them to grow. According to my research, 30 enslaved planters could plant 2 acres a day. To visualize this, we're talking about 30 people planting in an area about the size of 2 football fields. The total acreage a plantation owner had wouldn't all be planted at the same time. You wouldn't want it to all come to harvest at the same time. When it was ready, though, workers would use a tool with a big blade on the end to cut the cane stalks. The stalks would then be transported to mills that were powered first by cattle and mules or oxen. The cattle wouldn't live for very long, so mills were later powered by windmills. At these mills, cane would be fed through wooden or metal rollers to crush the cane. It was imperative, or all important, that the cane made it to the mills and then the boiling house within 2 days, or it would begin to spoil and ferment. Since there was a small window of time to process the cane, the production worked around the clock, meaning 24 hours a day, people were working on the harvesting and the processing of that cane so it wouldn't ferment. Once the cane was crushed, it would release the sugary juice. Next, the juice would go to the boiling house to be reduced to sugar cane syrup and molasses. These boiling houses could not be cooled, and recorded temperatures report temperatures of 120 to 140 degrees. How could this working environment lead to danger for enslaved workers? Working through the night and when overworked and exhausted led to serious and grave danger for many enslaved people. They were mistreated by workers, underfed, they struggled with disease such as yellow fever, and they were often maimed and disfigured by the mill rollers and the blades that they had to use. When sugarcane syrup and the molasses was processed, it was then exported to other Caribbean islands, such as Barbados and New England colonies, to be fermented and distilled for rum. Ferment is the natural process by which bacteria causes a chemical change in the sugar, producing an alcohol. Working through the night and when overworked and exhausted led to serious and grave danger for many enslaved people. They were mistreated by workers, underfed, struggled with diseases such as yellow fever. They were often maimed and disfigured by the mill rollers and the blades they had to use. People, when they're overworked and they're overtired, start to make mistakes. Plus, they're working 24 hours a day. It's very, very hot, and they can't see as well in the dark. So all of these lead to hazards for them. When sugarcane syrup and the molasses was processed, it was then sent to other Caribbean islands, such as Barbados and New England colonies, to be fermented and distilled. So it was an export to Barbados and New England, where they would make rum. Ferment is the natural process by which bacteria causes a chemical change in the sugar, producing an alcohol. Now, I'm going to tell you a little aside here. Many, many years ago, more than 20 years ago, going on 30 years ago, I was in Montana one summer, and a grain train that had been filled with corn had overturned, and all that corn was dumped out off onto the tracks in the countryside. Well, it was the summer, and so it was very hot, and the corn was exposed to the sun. The natural fermenting process began, but the bears aren't so able to discern what's good and what's bad, so they were enjoying their free, tasty treat of corn, and it was having an effect on them. They were walking around silly. They were getting into trash. They were unsteady on their feet from eating this corn that had fermented and now contained alcohol. By 1660, rum was being distilled in Boston, New York, and Philadelphia. So now it's going to be exported. It's going to be exported to England. It's going to be exported into Europe, but it's also going to be consumed there in the colonies as well. It was first sold as a medicine. That's curious. I do want to give you a quick illustration of supply and demand. As more rum was being made, more was available to be sold in colonial America, Europe, and abroad. So as the availability of that product is going up, you guessed it, the price of rum goes down. It's becoming really affordable. According to a Princeton study, in 1600, sugar would have cost approximately 30 pence a pound. By 1850, it would have cost just a little over 5 pence a pound. Over time, rum became a common item to barter with instead of paying with currency or coins. So this sugar is in high demand. It's now become a commodity. It's a commodity because plenty of people want to buy it, not because sugar cane itself is the end product, but because of what you can do with that sugar cane. Rum was even used to pay for enslaved Africans that were then sent to work on those very sugar plantations. By the mid-1800s, more than 10 million Africans were enslaved and moved to Brazil and the Caribbean to work on sugar plantations. Sugarcane now accounted for, as I've said before, one-third of Europe's entire economy. So King George III, when we're coming into the Revolutionary War, backing up a little bit from the mid-1800s, he's going to be busy trying to keep his hold on the colonies he has that have sugar plantations because sugar is so important to the economy of Europe and Britain. So he's going to be a little distracted, and we're going to find out more about that as we are studying the colonies and the leading up to the American Revolution. Before I close out today's episode, I've got a few more things that I want to talk about, but so far I think I've done a pretty good job here of answering for you where the sugarcane originated, which is Southeast Asia. I've talked about why it was able to grow so well in the Caribbean and the northern part of South America, and why it became such a commodity, a hot item people actually really wanted to buy, even though they really didn't need it. But before we go judging the people of that time period, let's take a look at how that sugar impact has increased over time. Before the triangular trade began, Europeans consumed about a teaspoonful of sugar per year. They really didn't have a whole lot of exposure to it unless they were really rich. By 1800, 18 pounds of sugar per United Kingdom head was consumed. So that means that by 1800, so we've been talking about a time period that's more like the 1600s, the 1500s, now we're up to the 1800s, about 18 pounds of sugar per United Kingdom person was consumed per year. Let's fast forward to today. Americans consume as much as 77 pounds of sugar and related sweeteners per person per year, according to the U.S. Department of Agricultural data. So at first glance, it may seem like, what's the big deal? But when we think about how often sugar is involved in our food, we are still very much tied to sugar. Most of our sugar today comes from Brazil, but sugar is still produced in the U.S., in Florida, Louisiana, and southern Texas. I did a little research, and at this time, still more than one half of the sugarcane harvested is harvested by hand. It's a very time-consuming, dangerous process. Also, according to tolerance.org, sugar is still being produced using child labor in 14 countries. The U.S. is not one of them, but in 14 countries. Today, sugarcane is used not just for food, but also for biofuel. There is a portion of that cane. Remember how I said that it's really fibrous? It's kind of like celery. So you're going to have a fibrous byproduct after you've taken off the sugarcane juice. That is called bagasse, and it is used for biofuel. More than 60% of processed sugar comes from sugarcane, but 40% comes from sugar beets, which got me thinking about what I had told you in the beginning, that I had a neighbor that grew up in Janesville, and he remembered when there was a very large sugar beet factory on Delavan Drive. So I did a little bit of digging, and I did find an old publication from the 1930s, a report being given on the efforts to break free from the dependency on sugarcane as it's being imported into the United States, and to replace it with an alternative such as sugar beets. But what they found, what farmers found, was that although sugar beets are going to grow more easily in Wisconsin than sugarcane, where they're not going to get enough of a growing season, the sugar beet is really a time-consuming crop itself, and you're not going to get as much sugar from a sugar beet as you would from the sugar cane. But if you do live in the upper Midwest, specifically if you live in Wisconsin, we do use sugar beets today. We use that sugar juice that we get from the beet to put down on our roads when we know that it's going to be really snowy or icy. It's reducing the freezing point of the precipitation, so our roads aren't as dangerous. It also, because of the sugar content, is giving the salt and the sand something to stick to, and that is kind of a more natural process that Wisconsin tries to use instead of as much salt as they have in the past. The U.S. has also tried other sweeteners over the years, and really that's been out of necessity when sugar has been scarce. One sweetener example is sorghum, which I had the pleasure of tasting over the summer when I was on my trip to Monticello and I had it on some cornbread. In fact, I think I'm going to let my students try out some different types of sweeteners this week, just so that we can all see the difference between honey and sorghum and molasses versus the sugar cane. So sorghum is a grain from northeastern Africa. It became a southern U.S. crop in the 1900s. It became especially popular in the 1930s and 40s when the sugar was scarce. It was also popular during World War II when, if you remembered listening to my episode about the Victory Garden, sugar was being rationed. It was one of those items that you had to have the little stickers for. It was rationed to 12 ounces of sugar per week for a family. I learned that sugarcane was used to make molasses and then to make industrial alcohol, not to be consumed as a drink like rum, but instead to manufacture explosives. So that might be an interesting thing to think about for the future in terms of research. Another type of sweetener related to sugarcane that you may have heard of is blackstrap molasses. You may have had them in a ginger snap cookie around the holidays. It's a product of boiling down sugarcane three times, and at that point, only a small amount of sugar is still in there, but the few nutrients that are in sugar that are beneficial for our bodies are found in the molasses. So I hope that you got a little bit of an overview on how the triangular trade fits together with the Silk Road and how the sugar traveled over hundreds of years across that Silk Road through war, through trade, and then through the triangular trade as Europe was trying to expand their markets. There was more demand for the sugar, and there was also some unforeseen circumstances such as a climate change that forced these different countries, the Dutch, the Portuguese, the British, to find new places to grow these crops in order to continue to be successful with their economies. If you are an adult listening to this episode, I did consult a book that I thought was really interesting you may want to pick up. It's called Bittersweet, The Story of Sugar, and it's written by Peter, and I'm probably going to say this wrong, so I do apologize, McInnis. It's M-A-C-I-N-N-I-S. You may want to pick up this book. It really does talk about from the very beginning of chewing on sugarcane in New Guinea to some interesting power balances in the 21st century. Keep in mind that this episode really hooks into what my students are learning about right now with the triangular trade and just beginning to talk about the colonization of the New World. So without being too overwhelming, I wanted to provide some background for, you know, what is this big deal with the sugar? You may also want to visit the tolerance.org website. They had a great lesson plan on there that you could utilize in your classroom, or if you're homeschooling, you may want to look into that a little bit more. And I encourage everyone, make some cornbread. As always, thank you so much for listening to this episode. I would love to have you leave me comments, ask a question, let me know if you try out some different substitutions for sugar. Love to hear all about it. You can drop me a line at artifactspodcast@gmail.com. Also, you can see a list of my sources at artifactspodcasthome.wordpress.com.